Good morning. On today's programme, the risk of a full-blown regional war in the Democratic Republic of Congo and hopes of an end to the 40-year-old rebellion of Kurdish militants in Turkey. But first we go to Canada. US President Donald Trump continues to threaten punishing tariffs against Canada and Mexico, saying recently that they're on time and on schedule for March the 4th. That's after a month-long reprieve. He's also continuing his rhetoric about making Canada the 51st state. That's not sitting well with the vast majority of Canadians, and the result has been a dramatic pushback against the United States. Dan Karpinchuk has this report from Toronto.
There's a certain amount of national pride in the air these days across Canada, in the face of tariffs and Trump's talk of annexation. And nowhere was that more evident than in a recent hockey game between Canada and the U.S. It was the Four Nations Cup, and the final pitted the best American players against the best Canadians, all from the National Hockey League. And when Connor McDavid scored in sudden-death overtime during that final game played in Boston, Canadians in the stands and in their sports bars and living rooms roared to their feet, bursting with emotion as Canada beat the U.S. 3-2. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau on social media posted, "You can't take our country and you can't take our game." A sentiment echoed from coast to coast to coast. In Washington, the Oval Office was silent. It wasn't just a game. It was a geopolitical struggle that pitted Canada, the David, against America, the mighty Goliath. And it's become serious. Most Canadians are feeling as if their very existence as a country is at stake. Many of those hockey fans could lose their jobs when and if Trump's tariffs begin to bite. Some are already being laid off as companies shore up their bottom lines in anticipation of Trump's punishing duties of 25% on all Canadian imports. Canadians are also angry. At hockey games and basketball games, they've started to boo the American national anthem. It's the only way they can let Trump know how they feel. A recent Angus Reid survey suggests that 78% of Canadians are making a concerted effort to buy more Canadian products and ignore U.S. goods. Some are boycotting American products, even at a higher cost. And they're buying and displaying Canadian flags in record numbers to show their support for Canadian companies and businesses. In grocery stores, they become more diligent about reading labels to find out where the products are made. And they're buying Canadian or from countries other than the U.S., uniting in their pride as Canadians like never before. Restaurants across the country are switching to Canadian products for fresh produce during the winter. Some say they'll turn to Mexico. Restaurant owners like Donald Wingell in Ottawa say he does all his shopping for fruits and vegetables locally and has stopped going to the big suppliers. He says in his restaurant, all American wines have been replaced with either Canadian wines or European wines, and American beer is no longer served. And it's not just products. Many Canadians are reconsidering their vacation plans to the U.S. Statistics Canada says Canadians account for more than 20 million travel visits to the U.S. each year. The American Travel Association says it's expecting those numbers to drop this year by as much as 15%. And that will gain attention south of the border. It's estimated Canadian travelers spend about $20 billion a year in the U.S. Many say they're willing to change their travel plans, even if it means losing their refunds or tickets or bookings. In Florida, one American real estate agent reports that she has 35 property listings on her books. 30 of them are Canadian seniors who no longer want to live in the U.S. Immigration lawyers in British Columbia and other provinces are reporting a spike in the number of Americans inquiring about relocating to Canada. And at least one couple living in BC say they're in the process of giving up their American citizenship because they no longer want to be associated with a country that has Donald Trump as its president. Another recent survey, this time from Léger, shows that even though it will be painful, 70% of Canadians support dollar-for-dollar retaliatory tariffs against the U.S., and even with Trump threatening to use economic force to annex Canada. Analysts say it's a sign that Canadians are angry and willing to have their own government take action, even though it will hurt their wallets. This week, Ontario's Doug Ford, the premier of the country's most populous province, won a historic provincial election. Not since 1959 has a party in Ontario won three consecutive majorities. Ford called the snap election, saying he needed a strong mandate to deal with the tariffs threatened by Trump. Ford and other premiers have traveled back and forth to Washington trying to convince the Trump administration that tariffs are a bad idea and would hurt Americans as much as Canadians. Ford has become a self-styled Captain Canada, advocating not only for Ontario but for Canada, as the federal government in Ottawa is treading water while the Liberals select a new leader to replace Justin Trudeau. For World Report, I'm Dan Karpinchuk in Toronto.
Next, we go to the Democratic Republic of Congo, where M23 rebels and Rwandan troops have captured two major cities in the east of the country, and they're still on the march. The UN says there's a risk of a full-blown regional war erupting in Central Africa. International pressure on Rwanda is mounting, but it's not clear whether it will stop the violence. Emmett Livingston reports from Kinshasa.
An explosion went off on Thursday, February 27th, in the middle of a crowd in Bukavu, one of the largest cities in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. Official sources said that over 10 people were killed. This kind of attack is rare in Congo, and it's a sign of the growing instability in the Central African country as M23 rebels and Rwandan forces advance, destabilizing the already weak central government. The public figurehead of the M23 rebels, Corneille Nangaa, was the person addressing the crowd. It's not clear who committed the attack, but Nangaa later said that it would not remain without consequences, hinting at further territorial expansion. Since January, the M23 rebels have been advancing almost unchecked in eastern Congo, an area filled with militia groups as well as mineral resources such as gold and coltan. The M23 is a group led by ethnic Congolese Tutsi commanders. In late 2021, it launched a campaign that saw it capture huge chunks of Congo's North Kivu province, and by 2022, it had surrounded eastern Congo's largest city, Goma, which lies on the Rwandan border. Fighting continued in the countryside, with the M23 steadily expanding its territory, but the situation around Goma remained relatively stable. The M23 says it's fighting to protect minority communities such as the Tutsi in Congo, as well as against a predatory central government. For the government in the capital, Kinshasa, however, the rebels are little more than pawns of its neighbour, Rwanda. Rwanda has deployed up to 4,000 troops inside Congo to support the M23, according to UN experts. It's also deployed sophisticated weaponry such as precision-guided munitions and surface-to-air missiles. In North Kivu, the stasis on the battlefield broke in late January, just after US President Donald Trump came to office. M23 rebels alongside Rwandan troops, according to the UN and other sources, moved to capture Goma itself. The fighting was vicious. The government-controlled pocket around the city of about 2 million people was filled with Congolese soldiers, militia fighters, European mercenaries, and troops from South Africa, Tanzania, Malawi, and Burundi. There were also thousands of UN peacekeepers defending the city. All those forces were defeated. The M23 took control of Goma after days of fierce urban combat featuring artillery and machine gun fire. Afterwards, M23 head Corneille Nangaa vowed that he and his forces would continue all the way to Kinshasa. It didn't take long before the M23 was marching again. The rebels pushed into the neighbouring province of South Kivu and captured Kavumu Airport. According to several security sources, they were helped by strikes from Turkish-made Bayraktar drones conducted by Rwanda's military. When they took the airport, the rebels cut off the Congolese army's last means of supplying itself in the region and in a stroke won the conflict militarily. A few days later, in mid-February, the M23 marched into the city of Bukavu uncontested. The Congolese army, as well as soldiers from its last active military ally, Burundi, was in full retreat across the plain south of the city. It's not clear what will happen next. Congo's government, led by President Felix Tshisekedi, has been thoroughly humiliated, losing control over vast tracts of territory, including eastern Congo's two largest cities. Tshisekedi told leaders of his political coalition that he was prepared to keep fighting, despite the fact that his army is routed. There are fears, which have been echoed by the UN and other world actors, of a full-blown regional war breaking out. Uganda, another state that borders Congo's east, has also pushed soldiers further inside the country, according to security sources. But the circumstances of Uganda's deployment remains murky. The nightmare scenario is a replay of the 1998-2003 Second Congo War, which is also known as Africa's Great War. Back then, 9 African nations vied for influence inside Congo. According to some estimates, millions of Congolese people died in that war, mostly from hunger and disease. Congo's government has for years been pushing for sanctions on Rwanda, which denies involvement, hoping that this would stop the conflict. Serious discussions regarding sanctions are only now on the table, following the fall of Goma. On February 20th, the US sanctioned a Rwandan minister and former army general accused of coordinating Rwanda's moves inside Congo. Washington also sanctioned the spokesman of the M23. The UK, for its part, announced that it was stopping most bilateral aid to Rwanda and that it was examining the possibility of sanctions. These are victories for the Congolese government, but it may be too little, too late. And still, economic sanctions targeting Rwanda or its leader Paul Kagame haven't been forthcoming. In Kinshasa, about 1,500 kilometres from eastern Congo, there's increasing apprehension as the rebels have vowed to overthrow the government. Foreign embassies have sent most staff home, and there are fears of instability such as looting or perhaps even an attempted coup in the city. African countries are trying to mediate, with new veteran statesmen appointed to solve the political impasse. But for the moment, few have much hope in the prospect of diplomacy. Negotiations have repeatedly failed over the years. For World Report, this is Emmett Livingstone in Kinshasa, DRC.
Finally, we go to Turkey, where hope has been raised of an end to the 40-year-old rebellion by Kurdish militants. The militants have decided to lay down their arms, but the question is, will the government reciprocate and deliver the reforms that the Kurds want? From Ankara, Jasper Mortimer reports.
3 days ago, Abdullah Öcalan, the imprisoned leader of the Kurdistan Workers' Party, better known as the PKK, called on his fighters to lay down their arms. In a statement read out by Kurdish MPs who had just returned from his prison, Öcalan said the PKK should disband. What Turks are pondering today is whether this initiative will actually lead to peace. More than 40,000 people have died since the PKK opened fire in 1984. For several years now, the conflict has been confined to northern Syria and Iraq. But every now and then, a bomb explodes in a Turkish city, killing dozens of people. Whether we achieve peace depends on 2 factors. Firstly, whether the government matches Öcalan's move by making changes to improve the lot of the Kurds, who number about 15 million people, or 18% of the population. Öcalan has told the PKK to lay down its arms twice before, in 1999 and in 2013. Each time, the PKK resumed fighting because it found the government had not delivered the reforms the Kurds expected. Secondly, peace depends on the reaction of the PKK commanders in the field. A PKK-linked news agency published that the group's executive committee had said, quote, "In response to the call of our leader Abdullah Öcalan, we announce a ceasefire starting today." However, the statement indicated the PKK would not disband until Öcalan had been released and allowed to meet the PKK leaders. Öcalan had called on the PKK to convene a congress and decide to integrate with society. The PKK statement said such a congress could only be held with Öcalan as its chairman. It said peace demands Öcalan's full freedom, physically, intellectually, and politically. All of this is good news. It had been feared the PKK commanders would decide to go on fighting until the government had made the reforms they've been fighting for. Instead, the commanders have decided to cease fire as a big step towards achieving their political goals. In what seemed like a veiled warning, the PKK said the government should have taken many steps years ago, but it did not. Now, it said, the steps must be taken without delay. When one walks around Diyarbakir, the unofficial Kurdish capital of Turkey, and asks people what they want, one hears 3 things: freedom for Öcalan, a measure of autonomy for the Kurdish-majority provinces of Turkey, and schooling in the Kurdish language. Teaching in Kurdish is particularly important, as Kurds regard their language as the foundation of their culture. Some of the Kurds' demands are reforms that would improve life for all citizens of Turkey, The anti-terrorism laws, for instance, enable the government to arrest people for offences that would not be regarded as criminal in Western Europe. Since the local elections in March last year, the government has deposed about 15 mayors and deputy mayors and installed unelected officials in their places. Most of these mayors belong to the pro-Kurdish party, DEM, but a few of them belong to the biggest opposition party, the CHP. Human rights groups accuse President Recep Tayyip Erdogan of using the law to lock up his political opponents. The three biggest names are the Kurdish politicians Selahattin Demirtas and Figen Yüksekdağ, and the Turkish philanthropist Osman Kavala. They have been in prison for years, despite the European Court of Human Rights calling for their release. This means the peace process is actually bigger than the Kurdish issue. For to satisfy the Kurds, Erdogan must make reforms that would liberalize society as a whole. And there is doubt over whether he's prepared to do that. But putting an end to bombs going off in public places would be a massive achievement. Öcalan's move is one that must be sustained, not squandered. For World Report, this is Jasper Mortimer in Ankara.
Well, that's it from World Report for today. The programme was edited by Margaret Curley. If you want to listen back, you can go to rte.ie/World Report or on all podcast platforms. We're back again at the same time next week. Until then, from myself, Justin McCarthy, and all the team, thanks for listening and take care.